It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about a new effort in Wisconsin to save the monarch butterfly and find out how you can help out. First, election security has been in the news lately, especially after last week's federal indictments of 12 Russian intelligence agents accused of attempting to disrupt the country's elections in 2016. And with just 3 weeks before Wisconsin's statewide primaries, there's a renewed focus on what state officials are doing to shore up security. That includes questions about why the state has not yet filled 6 election security positions at the State Elections Commission. Mark Sommerhauser covers state government and politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Rob.
We'll talk about these still vacant positions. What kind of functions would they be responsible for?
Sure. So we're talking about 6 positions with the State Elections Commission, which is the state agency that oversees elections here in Wisconsin. All 6 have some responsibilities relating to election security. And, you know, talking to the commission, it sounds like 3 of the 6 positions are really intensely focused on security. 2 of the positions are working in information technology. And a 3rd is a trainer position, a security trainer position for a staff person who would work with local elections officials to train them on security measures. So those 3 positions in particular are, almost entirely devoted to securing our elections.
Give us a little history behind the creation of these jobs. These positions were just put into effect earlier this year, right?
Yeah, they were created by the commission earlier this year. When the commission was able to secure some federal funding, a $7 million federal grant to create these positions, the commission had asked the legislature and the governor to provide some funding for some new staff positions in the last budget. The legislature, both Republicans and Democrats in the legislature, did go along with that request and provide funding for some new positions, and the governor did veto that funding. But the positions were created anyway when the state was able to get federal money to fund them.
And do we know why these positions haven't been filled yet, if that is going back to April?
Right. The account that I've gotten in speaking to both the Elections Commission and the Department of Administration, which is part of its role is to perform hiring and HR functions across state agencies, including the Elections Commission. The Elections Commission says that they provided the information to the Department of Administration back in May, that the administration department needed to, get these positions listed and start to seek out applicants for them. The administration department in turn tells us that it went through some staffing issues, some turnover issues, especially back in June, that did affect its ability to get this and other state government vacancies filled. But they have assured us that those issues are resolved and that they're moving, in their words, expeditiously to try to get, in particular, these elections vacancies filled.
Talking to Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin State Journal about open positions in the state's election division, some of which are focused on security. Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf was on Upfront with Mike Goucher yesterday. Here's a little of what she had to say about hacking attempts on the state's election system.
Every day they see thousands, if not millions, of people trying to find a way into that system. But it really is a success story in that there haven't been any successful attempts to get into that statewide enterprise.
Mark, the fact that these positions aren't filled doesn't mean the barn door is wide open, right? There are positions in place, there are procedures in place trying to protect the state's election system, even without these positions being filled, right?
That's correct. And, the Elections Commission has been very emphatic about the point that they feel confident in the security of our elections now as it stands. But by the same token, like any enterprise, they always welcome more reinforcements, right? They always welcome more help to try to accomplish that goal. The other agency that's really critical in these efforts is the Division of Enterprise Technology, which is basically the IT agency across state government. And they're really the agency that oversees a lot of the efforts to make sure that no one that's not supposed to be getting access to our election system gets in there.
And we know from those federal indictments filed a week ago Friday that a state's election system had been at least in some way compromised by Russian hackers, according to this indictment. It not Wisconsin, it looks like. What do we know about whether there have been attempts to access Wisconsin websites, especially election websites?
Yeah, that's right. So the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency, did disclose last year that there were at least one and possibly multiple attempts to gain access to a server here in Wisconsin that was tied to the Department of Workforce Development. The belief, at least among federal security officials, is that, and that was, I should say, an attempt that was linked to Russian government cyber actors. The belief that U.S. Intelligence officials had was that they were doing that to see if they could gain access from workforce development servers, potentially to the servers that relate to our elections, and they were not able to gain access to any state infrastructure or servers, according to Homeland Security officials, but that attempt was made. We do have examples of other states, for instance, just next door to us in Illinois, where Russian, individuals linked to the Russian government were able to successfully gain access to their voter registration database in that state.
Do we have an idea of when these positions could be filled if the Department of Administration is rolling on them now? Would it be by the primaries in just, 3 weeks from tomorrow?
It does not look like they're going to be filled by the primaries. The positions have not been listed or posted yet. Now, we're told that some of them are supposed to be have the job vacancies posted this week. But it looks like the primary is going to be too heavy of a lift. The Department of Administration, however, is saying that they're confident that these positions will be filled, in advance of the general election on November 6th. And I think the question now is just how far in advance of that election and how much those individuals are going to be able to contribute in terms of securing our elections in the lead up to November 6th.
Has this been a partisan issue so far? Has there been a partisan debate over protecting Wisconsin's elections and these positions in particular?
So I think the answer to that is no, in the sense that we've seen Republicans and Democrats concur on the value of these new staff positions. Talking to the chairman of the State Elections Commission, Dean Knudsen, a former Republican state lawmaker, he was very clear that he felt that these positions, were valuable. They needed to be filled quickly. So I wouldn't say there's really been partisanship. I would say that, the one area where we've maybe seen some difference between parties is, Democrats have been a little more willing to sort of point the finger at Governor Scott Walker's administration for, not acting more swiftly to fill these positions. Republicans, affirming the importance of the positions, have not been as quick to point the finger at the governor's administration.
As we wrap up, Mark, is it fair to say nobody's feeling a sense of panic that we're desperately vulnerable, but a little extra help wouldn't hurt?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think, in light of what we saw in 2016, in light of federal national security officials warning that there is a strong possibility that there could be renewed attempts here in 2018 and beyond by Russians or other individuals that might want to compromise our election systems, there really is an effort to make sure that it's all hands on deck to make sure that Wisconsin elections are secure.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
That's Mark Sommerhauser, state government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, with us to talk about a handful of election security positions left unfilled so far at the State Elections Commission, just 3 weeks ahead of the August primaries. Right now, a new alliance of groups in Wisconsin is teaming up to save the monarch butterfly. Over the past two decades, the population of monarchs in the eastern U.S. has dropped by 80%. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is expected to decide next summer whether to add the monarch to the endangered species list. Researchers say action is needed soon to bring those numbers back up. That brings in the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative. It's made up of more than 70 groups, including nonprofits, government, utility companies, and more. The collaborative has drafted Wisconsin's part of a regional strategy that covers 16 states. Owen Boyle is the Species Management Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's also the DNR's lead representative to the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative. Owen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, let's first talk about how bad things are for monarch butterflies. What's going on?
Well, they're not good. As you said, 80% decline over the last two decades, and we're talking about formerly one of the most abundant, most certainly iconic and most recognizable insect species in the world. And those populations are down for a number of reasons, but primarily it's due to habitat loss. And really much of that habitat loss has been from what we think of as the Corn Belt, sort of the Midwestern former prairie states.
And that's what the collaborative seems to be focusing on, if I have this right. Getting more of that landscape, that environment, the habitat that the monarchs need.
That's absolutely right. So it's all about habitat, and it's in particular, it's about milkweed. Now, of course, monarchs need all kinds of plants, flowering plants for nectaring and, you know, to be able to replace energy. But the only plants that they can lay eggs on and the only plants that their caterpillars can eat are plants in the group of milkweeds.
Who is at the table in this collaborative?
Oh, gosh. Who isn't, actually, maybe is the better question. The outpouring of just support and really people stepping up. And you mentioned 70 organizations and individuals that are part of the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, everything from all levels of government, from municipal to federal, many, many non-governmental organizations, nonprofits, and in some cases, some folks that aren't used to working together, from roadside managers to farmers to protected and natural areas managers, to master gardeners and folks who live in the city. This is one of the really, really exciting thing about monarch conservation is that literally anybody can get involved, no matter where you are, no matter what you do in life. If you could have an apartment on a high-rise building and plant some flowers on your balcony and do things that are good for monarchs and for pollinators.
Is there a number that we have in mind, either here in Wisconsin or in this regional effort, like we want X amount of space devoted to monarch-friendly habitat?
It's less about space than about habitat, again, and habitat being defined as number of milkweed stems. So both at the national level and actually international level, but then all the way down to the state level, we're setting goals that are milkweed stems, literally. And we've figured out that we need about 120 million additional stems of milkweed in the state of Wisconsin by 2038. That's our portion of, as you mentioned before, the Mid-America strategy, which aims to add 1.3 billion stems of milkweed to essentially the upper Midwest, again, by 2038. And the ultimate goal, the target of that's agreed upon by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is 6 hectares, so that's a measurement of land area, 6 hectares of overwintering monarchs in Mexico. Because remember, all of the butterflies you see here in Wisconsin in October, maybe September, every single one of those guys is going to be flying thousands of miles down to Mexico to overwinter in the high-elevation montane forest. And so that is the ultimate goal, 6 hectares of monarchs in Mexico.
Talking to Owen Boyle from the state DNR and representative to the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, talking about efforts to bring back milkweed, to bring back monarch butterfly numbers in the state and around the eastern half of the country. Owen, let's talk about how different people can get involved. And let's talk about maybe homeowners or people with a little bit of land to work with. I accidentally got involved. I think I started having these plants pop up. I thought they were weeds. Turns out they're milkweed. I promoted them to plants and just let them grow and started putting in flowers around them. That everybody doing a little of that can make a difference, really?
Yes, absolutely correct. And that's, again, one of the great things that we've got going for us and that monarchs have going for them is that milkweeds are easy to grow and they are, in many cases, weeds, right? And so sometimes we don't have to just plant new milkweed. Sometimes we just don't have to mow it. So like roadside managers, for example, just maybe there are certain areas they have to mow, but if they can, just leave some areas unmown and the milkweed will grow. I had the same situation at my house here in Madison. I had some milkweeds just volunteer, and we've been producing monarchs every year.
If I'm at the garden store, the nursery, can I just buy milkweed seeds?
You can buy milkweed seeds. You know, depending on your situation, often it's faster and you have a higher success rate if you buy plugs or, you know, plants that are already a couple of years old. And there are many species of milkweeds. We highly, highly recommend that folks buy and plant native milkweed plants. There is a tropical milkweed that we recommend folks avoid. It's not as nutritious for monarchs, and it can cause other issues. You know, we think about invasive species and whatnot.
So these plants, I'm sorry, I don't want to make this all about me, but these plants that are volunteering in your yard and my yard, those are probably the local fellas?
Those are, yeah, certainly. And those are more than likely common milkweed, which is by far the most abundant and widespread and really what everybody thinks of probably when they think milkweed, yeah.
Okay, thumbs up to that. And then around that milkweed, what can people plant to provide nourishment? Like the milkweed's great for the caterpillars, right?
Correct.
Especially, what about that nectar that the butterflies need?
Really, any species that are native prairie species. So these are generally plants that like to grow out in the sun. Things like liatris or blazing star, some of your coneflowers, basically any native prairie plant. You can get that to grow in your yard or, you know, in an old field next to your house. You're going to be doing good things, not just for monarchs, but for all pollinators. And I should say that when we talk about stems of milkweed goals, it is, as you're alluding to, Rob, that we really do need that full habitat, the whole suite of nectar plants, too, that are blooming from spring through fall.
And I know you're hoping that farmers join in, too, and they don't need to shut down an entire field, but maybe they can find some nooks and crannies.
Exactly. Yeah. No, we're not talking about agricultural fields. We're talking about what are traditionally thought of as waste places, hedgerows and sort of the places that aren't actively cultivated for farming and even gardens, you know, whether you live in the city or out in the country. Just about anybody can plant a garden or at least plant some flowers and pots.
And are we seeing farmers are already joining in on this year?
Oh, definitely. And not even joining in, but just the really interesting thing, one of the interesting things to me about this collaborative is just finding out how much is already going on out there. And, you know, we've got a lot of work to do to get to those 120 million stems of milkweed embedded in a diverse matrix of nectar plants. But it's been really interesting and really fun to hear all the great stories, again, from farmers to roadsides to urban and suburban lawns.
And you've mentioned pollinators a couple times. What kind of things do we count on monarch butterflies to pollinate in the state?
Well, monarchs aren't the kind of pollinators, like really when you're talking about pollination and sort of the ecological service that pollinators provide, really bees are where it's at. They are the best, most efficient pollinators. Most butterflies do pollinate. They're not necessarily, there are no crops or individual
right.
native plants that absolutely rely on monarchs per se. But yeah, they do some amount of pollination, but certainly not as much as the bees do.
And if we're making these habitats that are monarch butterfly friendly, are there some freeloaders, some other pollinators who are going to benefit from that?
Yeah, definitely. They just about all of them will. And, you know, we've seen in recent times things like rusty patch bumblebee that was added to the federal endangered species list last year. And there are some others coming that are also pretty rare. All of those bee and bumblebee species can benefit, you know, pollinators in general can benefit.
I want to bring on a caller now. Anne is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. You touched on this a little bit, but I wish the DNR would push the towns and the counties to stop mowing the ditches. I mean, I can see where they would like to mow corners, but we take out thousands of miles of, you know, flowering plants and milkweeds, cutting ditches that we could do at the end of this, you know, the season when the monarchs have done their thing.
And thanks a lot for the call. And is this something that's actually happening on?
Yeah, it is. And actually, that's one of the focuses of our rights of way managers, the working group as part of the collaborative. They're looking at ways that, you know, counties and municipalities can do some sort of targeted non-mowing, right? And they can actually save money by mowing less land and also do good things for monarchs. Again, you don't necessarily have to plant the milkweed, just don't cut it down when it's growing. So yeah, that is absolutely one of the ways where our rights of way group is looking for action.
And thanks a lot for that call. And now this is a multi-state effort. So we're doing this in Wisconsin, and I guess other states are having similar conversations?
Yes, exactly. It's about 16 states are in the primary migratory flyway of monarch butterflies from Texas up to the Dakotas over to Ohio and western Pennsylvania. So all of those states are actively involved in this collaborative. Again, it's an amazing effort. I've actually never seen anything like this in terms of size and scale to save a species. It's remarkable.
When do you hope to start seeing results if homeowners are doing this and, you know, we're not mowing along the roadsides and so forth? When will we start to see, hopefully, fingers crossed, numbers?
Excellent question. So the plan horizon, again, as I mentioned earlier, is 20 years. We hope to see some results certainly before then. It can take a few years for sure for numbers to build up. So I'm hoping within the next 2-3 years, maybe that overwintering number of monarchs we will start to see climbing up.
Now, if people are out there listening, and again, whether they're, you know, homeowners or they have a business or a farm or whatever, are there ways they can officially sign on or informally go to get some resources to work with?
Absolutely, at least the informal part. If you visit the DNR's website and search on the keyword pollinators, you'll get a whole bunch of information, possibly more than you ever wanted, but lots of information about native gardening with native plants and native plant nurseries. There's also ways that folks can contribute through citizen science, volunteering and getting trained to collect information about monarchs. One common project that folks know about is Monarch Watch, where people actually put little tags, capture monarchs, put little tags on them, and they look at the recovery rates down in Mexico. Get online, look at the Monarch Joint Ventures website, and search for citizen science opportunities. There's a lot out there.
And have you actually counted the milkweed stems in your yard?
Yes.
How many you got so far?
I have 13.
13? I'm
lucky number 13.
I'm competing,
right.
I think, so far.
They
spread
some,
on
though.
Their own. It's great.
They do.
Owen, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Owen Boyle is the Species Management Section Chief of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We talked to him about the newly created Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, which aims to save the monarch butterfly by getting people to help build habitat, mainly by letting those milkweed plants grow. First, comedy movies are in a big screen slump. Unless there's a surprise breakout, this would be the first year that no traditional comedy grosses more than $100 million at the U.S. box office since 1995, and that's when movie tickets were 52% cheaper. Game Night has brought in the most money so far this year at just $69 million, and Amy Schumer's I Feel Pretty is finishing its box office run with $49 million. It's less than half of her 2015 debut hit, Trainwreck.
You probably haven't been here before, but you have to wait in line and take a number.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
I can grab it for you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I just... Here.
Thank you.
And this guy just calls out, like, a number completely out of sequence.
Okay.
It's like a weird game of bingo.
All right.
But no one wins.
For comparison, National Lampoon's Animal House, Blazing Saddles, Beverly Hills Cop, Home Alone, and Ghostbusters all topped $500 million when adjusted for inflation. So what's going on with the comedy genre? Ben Fritz is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who covers the film business and media companies. He's also the author of the new book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, is there a simple explanation for this decline, apparently, in movie comedy revenues?
You know, there's no simple explanation, and a lot of people in Hollywood are struggling to understand it. You know, dramas have been doing poorly for a while. Everyone blamed that. On the fact that there's so many great dramas on television now, on Netflix, HBO, Amazon, et cetera, that, you know, didn't used to be on TV back before premium cable and streaming. But the comedy genre is a little more complicated, and people are attributing it in part to the fact that a lot of the big blockbuster movies have more humor in them. If you look at a film like Deadpool or the most recent Avengers sequel, they have more funny bits in them than those movies used to have. So people are perhaps getting more of their comedy needs filled by some superhero movies, believe it or not. There's a lot more stand-up specials you can watch on Netflix now than there ever used to be. So stand-up comedy is much more readily available. A lot of young people are getting comedy on YouTube with pranks and that kind of thing, even Instagram, believe it or not. So there's just a lot more sources of content, a lot more ways to get comedy than your traditional live-action adult comedy, which used to be the primary way. A lot of people, you know, got comedic entertainment.
When you talk to people in the industry, is anybody thinking, well, you know, it's a temporary slump. These things come and go. We're not worried it's going to come back.
Some people are saying that, but frankly, the people who are being honest about the trends and honest about the numbers are admitting that's just not the case. If you look at the grosses for the top five comedies over the past decade, which I did, since 2013, they've been in decline. They've been in significant decline. And there's so far this year is the worst yet. I think there's a lot of reason to, you know, be concerned. You know, in 2013, the top five comedies grossed an average of $141 million. Last year it was 85 million, and that's been a steady decline. It's not like it's going up and down depending how good the films are. And when something happens for 5 years in a row, you've got to realize it's not just that the movies aren't good. There's actually a bigger trend happening.
Does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy where, okay, we've seen this run of comedies that we put money into not making money, so comedies move to the bottom of our priority list?
Well, I mean, studios are still making comedies, but it is true, you're right, they're making fewer of them, and when they do make them, they're making them at lower budgets. They're making them cheaper. It used to be you could spend $40, $50, $60 million even on a live action comedy. Now the studios would rather spend more like $25 million. And it certainly is true that these movies are getting made in a smaller level, but you would still think if the movie comedy is really good, you could have a big breakout hit that could gross more than $100 million. That used to be more common. You know, you'd see a movie like Trainwreck or Bridesmaids or something like that, the way that we used to, or Wedding Crashers or The Hangover. And that hasn't happened in a while. And, that's really the concern, is even the comedies that seem like they're good are just not breaking out the way they used to.
Talking about the decline of the movie comedy, at least in terms of people going to see it at the theater, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go to see funny movies anymore? Do action movies with a little bit of humor, do they fulfill that function for you? Or do you just wait and watch something at home later on? Ben Fritz is with us from the Wall Street Journal, author of the book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Ben, that said, these comedy movies aren't grossing a lot, but you mentioned they're willing to Hollywood producers are willing to put lower amounts of money. So are we seeing movies that are successful based on that more limited standard?
Well, yeah. So if you look at films this year, like Game Night you mentioned, or Book Club, they're doing fine for their cost tag, gross a little over $50 million. That's totally fine given their cost. They'll be profitable, but they're not really profitable. And, you know, for a genre to really thrive in Hollywood, you want to see some films, at least some films in the genre, do really well, gross hundreds of millions and be massively profitable. Because or else the studios are going to say, well, I could bet on a comedy and I'll make a small profit in success, or I could bet on a superhero movie or an action movie or a horror movie, and in success, I'll make a lot of money. So, you know, if the genre is going to thrive, you really like to see at least a few hits per year that are really, really successful, not just modestly successful.
We heard from Laura on Facebook, who says, why should I spend $30 to listen to someone else's kids yelling when I can stay home and listen to my own for free? And, you know, I think, oh, big action movie, okay, you want to see that on the big screen. And there was an idea that there was something similar in comedy. There was something special about not being in a room by yourself, but being in a room full of people laughing and sharing this experience together. And people thought, well, maybe comedies will be insulated. Not so much.
Yeah. So that was the thought in Hollywood for a while, was, look, clearly dramas are something we're happy to watch at home. It's a better experience. You don't need to pay $15 and go to a theater to see a bunch of adults talking, which is what a lot of dramas are essentially, right? But people thought, okay, certainly the big screen spectacle, the superhero movies, will do well in theaters. Horror, you want to see in a theater because it's a lot more fun to be scared in a dark room full of other people. And then comedy, because people thought, well, a lot of the conventional wisdom was it's more fun to laugh with other people. You know, it's when something's funny and you're in a room with 100 people laughing together, that's a better experience than sitting by yourself in a couch laughing. And comedy, for a while, seemed resistant to the trend. It wasn't declining like drama, but now it is. So it seems like that conventional wisdom is proving wrong, which is really depressing to a lot of comedy producers, comedy filmmakers.
Ben, what do you think, as somebody who reviews the industry, you like movies? I mean, do you think we miss something if we're watching that comedy on the living room couch instead of in a crowded theater?
I do think we miss a little bit. Look, I cannot blame somebody like your commenter from Facebook. Look, it costs money, especially if you have a family. It can be hard to justify. I totally get that. And I understand it's tough to take the risk. What if you go spend this money and it turns out the movie's not good? You know, if you stay home and watch something on Netflix or TV, you haven't really lost much money. You already subscribed to it, right? So I get all those things. But I have to say, like, when I think of the great comedy movies that I loved growing up, you know, I remember being in a theater full of, you know, hundreds of other people. We were all laughing together. And that's really different than sitting on your couch by yourself or with, you know, a couple other people in your family.
Yeah, thinking back, and I'm dating myself here a little, it seemed like every year the Eddie Murphy comedy was going to be a big hit. You know, there were misses there too, but there were bankable comedy stars who you put in a comedy movie and people were going to go see it. That's not true anymore.
No, I mean, Think of this, the run that Adam Sandler had back in the day when he was hugely successful. Think of all the romantic comedies with Julia Roberts. Surely, yeah, think of Eddie Murphy in the 80s and early 90s. You're 100% right. And now, you know, the today's comedy stars, there are not that many of them, and the ones that are around are inconsistent at best, and they've been struggling recently. And you mentioned, you know, there's been a Melissa McCarthy movie this year didn't do too well. There was an Amy Schumer movie this year that didn't do too well. We're really struggling to, you know, find another big comedy star who can consistently draw people to movies grossing $100 million or more, and maybe we're just not going to have anybody at that level anymore.
Are we going to see those people who might have been the comedy movie stars or writers and directors, for that matter, moving to other platforms?
Absolutely. I mean, they're, you know, you're right now, like Will Ferrell, for example, you know, who was a big comedy movie star, been struggling recently. He's doing a film for Netflix. Adam Sandler pretty much exclusively makes his comedies for Netflix now. We're absolutely, you know, there's no shortage of comedy in the world. It's just that there's not as much being made for movies that play in movie theaters.
We're talking about the box office decline of comedy movies with Ben Fritz. Ben covers the film business and media companies for the Wall Street Journal. We've talked to him in the past about his book, The Big Picture. He says the five most successful adult comedies grossed an average of $141 million in 2013. That went down to $109 million in 2015, only $85 million last year. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When was the last time you went to see a comedy at a movie theater on the big screen? Do you still enjoy comedy movies, or do you get enough laughs from other maybe action movies, or would you rather just watch them at home? Is there something special about seeing a comedy movie in a big theater full of people laughing along with you? Do you think they don't make them like they used to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
Or you could accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave. Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the decline of comedies at the box office. The 1984 film Ghostbusters there is the top grossing comedy of all time, raking in more than $242 million at the time. When adjusted for inflation, that's more than $610 million in today's dollars. Well, last year's box office winner, Girls Trip, took in only $117 million. We're talking to Ben Fritz, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He covers the film business and media companies. He's the author of The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What will it take for a comedy movie to get you to the theater? Or does it just not happen? Do you prefer to watch it at home? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Trevor is on the line in Plover. Trevor, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, the reason why my wife and I don't go to many comedies anymore is just for a moral standpoint. I remember when you can go see a comedy and you didn't have to hear the F word every other word, or it wouldn't be sexually motivated as they are now. And a lot of times you see movie after movie, like Mom's Night Out and all these movies where the moms are neglecting their kids and just kind of going out and party. I don't want to see none of that. You know, that's why we don't go out to the theater anymore.
Trevor, thanks a lot for the call. Trevor is not alone. Rick on Facebook says vulgar comedies are a real turnoff. Janice writes on Facebook that the violent oversex comedies out in the theaters don't represent the world. So this is a concern for some people. What do you think, Ben? Is this part of what's turning people off to vulgar comedy?
I think that makes some sense. There's certainly an audience that doesn't like the hard R-rated comedy, and I think studios are feeling some need to compete with all of the really edgy, explicit content you can find online on streaming platforms by getting edgier themselves, and maybe that's, in fact, turning off some people. That's also why, you know, one genre that is still doing well is the animated family comedy, like your Despicable Me, your Incredibles and so on, they have comedic elements in them at least. Those movies can do, it can do very, very well. Movies people are enjoy taking their kids to and that kids like to laugh at. All that said, though, there were comedies that were very edgy, R-rated comedies, you know, for their times. So, like, think of Wedding Crashers comes to mind, or The Hangover. Those are movies that had cursing in them and pretty sexually explicit, and they did very, very well. They grossed hundreds of millions of dollars. So even that type of film is still doing worse now than it used to.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Susie now in South Milwaukee. Susie, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say two of the reasons that we don't go anymore is, number one, the loudness of the movies themselves. It actually hurts your ears. They're so loud. And number two, I disagree with the gentleman that the crassness of these movies is not making a difference, because for a whole bunch of people that I know, it is, because we cannot go with our kids. So those are my two reasons.
Susie, thanks a lot for that call. So the too loud, I think, could apply to any movie genre, and clearly people are still going to see the superhero movies, which have a lot of the loudness, Ben.
Yeah, but you know, her point is valid in the sense that, you know, I think comedies are struggling, you know, all movies are struggling these days. The movie business, it's, box office is up a bit this year, but the ongoing trend overall is that theater attendance is down for the, you know, this century. And comedies are part of it, and I think right now if there's any kind of movie that you can get away with not seeing in a theater, people are increasingly not going, and people feel they have to see the big superhero, you know, tentpole movies, but maybe the comedies they don't need to see so much. And for all the reasons your caller said, including that they're loud and people talk and, you know, they're expensive, and perhaps, you know, for some people, these films in general are too violent, too crass, et cetera.
Susie, thanks a lot for the call. And I wonder, is there room for a Home Alone movie, which was a comedy? There was extreme violence when you think about it carefully, but not a lot of vulgarity, clearly. Is there room for a movie like that in today's theaters?
It's a good question, whether or not, like, the sort of live action kids comedy, you know, we think of the movies from the 80s, like Home Alone in the 90s, I guess, or Goonies from the 80s was a great one. You know, Hollywood doesn't make many movies like that anymore. There's been some talk about whether or not to try to bring them back. But I think the problem is, first of all, you know, there are a lot more animated movies that kids go to see instead of those live action ones. And also, a lot of kids like to go see the superhero movies. And, like, you know, even though they're PG-13, you see 8 and 10 year olds there all the time. And like I said, some of them even have comedic elements to them. So the competition for families' attention is very tough.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ben Fritz is with us from the Wall Street Journal, talking about the decline of the movie comedy, at least in terms of box office revenue. Back to your calls. And let us know, what is the last comedy you have gone to see at an actual theater? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alex is with us now in Oshkosh. Alex, hi.
Hi. I love the show. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
So I feel like now with movies nowadays, they seem to kind of pander more towards certain audiences, and the jokes in a lot of more modern comedy movies are kind of repeated and the same throughout, whereas back in the older movies, like Leslie Nielsen and Steve Carell and different things like that, they seemed more smart, more well-written, something that really the whole family could enjoy.
Alex, thanks a lot for that call. So he's saying comedies may be micro-targeted toward a certain audience, just repeating catchphrases or things like that, and think of like a movie like Airplane where, well, if you didn't like this joke, wait 3 seconds.
Yeah. Look, I mean, Airplane is a very specific type of film, and a great film. I loved it. I love it. You know, where it's just joke, 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 joke. You don't see too many films like that anymore. There's certainly more, interweave plot and characters. If you saw Game Night this year, that's what that was about. Book Club, Tag, they kind of have a little bit more serious stories where they want you to care about the characters more. They're not just completely silly like Airplane. And yeah, for people who prefer that kind of silliness and nonstop jokes, that's also something you're not getting so much of in theaters. And perhaps you'll get more of that if you watch like a good stand-up set on Netflix.
Thanks for that call. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say, first of all, I enjoyed Mr. Fritz's book, The Big Picture. It's one of the best books about modern Hollywood, or what's going on in the industry. in the last several years. I really enjoyed that book.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate that.
And I just wanted to say, and then maybe this has already been brought up. I just tuned in not too long ago. But it seems to me some of the more classic comedies, particularly in the 70s and 80s, were more character-driven in terms of comedy. I mean, when you bring up Ghostbusters and you think back, there's those three main characters, but each one had a distinct character to it. You know, you can picture them in your mind of how they acted and how they responded to certain situations, where now the comedy, it seems to me the comedy so that's written is so broad, it just one-liners, and it just doesn't seem as well written. I mean, when you think about like Animal House, John Belushi, and you know, you just these characters, those movies are made 40 years ago, but the characters still
I gotcha, Mike. Running short on time, I want to bring Ben in. Do you think there's anything to that, Ben?
I mean, I think, again, I think people often love the comedies of their youth or the comedies that that were classics to them. And I get what he's saying. All those movies he mentioned, like Animal House, are great ones. But, you know, you would think, you know, there's a new generation of comedic filmmakers all the time. They're speaking to a new generation of young people. You would think they'd be able to find something that would work for audiences today. I mean, you know, it's subjective opinion, but you could, you know, I think there are characters in some of the comedies released this year that are at least decent and interesting. There's something that's not resonating. It's not just, I don't think it makes sense to say Hollywood just doesn't know how to make a good movie anymore. Even though certainly there are some audiences like your caller, perhaps we're not getting what they love as much anymore.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. As we start to wrap up, Ben, maybe big screen isn't giving Mike or other people the movies that they want, but does it matter if Netflix or Hulu or TV or YouTube is giving us the comedy we want anyway?
Well, I think that's a big debate. It's one of the big debates in Hollywood right now. People who care about entertainment is it as long as you're getting the content, does it matter? On the one hand, you could say it doesn't matter. As you know, we're getting to watch it, and who cares where we see it? It's getting made. It's getting produced. But for those of us who think there's something special about a movie theater, there's something great about going out in a group, seeing something together, experiencing it together. It's a social, cultural event. I think it's a bit of a shame that it's gone. And, you know, I would say the more that people don't go to theaters to see different types of films like comedies, the more that Hollywood is only going to deliver superhero films and sequels, because those are the only ones that make money.
Briefly, Ben, before we wrap up, you know, there was a time when comic book movies weren't great. They were kind of a laughing stock, I think it's fair to say. Now, as you say, that's about all we get. Is there room for somebody to reinvent the big screen comedy?
Look, I think there's always an opportunity, and if somebody can find a way to do it that's really new and innovative, and it's really something, especially a comedy that really is better on the big screen than it is on an iPad or a TV or a phone, then hopefully that'll get people back into theaters. But that's clearly, it can't just be a funny movie. That's not good enough anymore. It's got to be something that's best seen on the big screen, and that's what I hope we see more creativity in the coming years.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Fritz is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers the film business and media companies. He's also the author of the book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. We talked to him about why fewer people are going out to see comedy movies in the theaters. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you still go see comedies? What do you like? What don't you like? Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the distinctive opening of Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. It hit the Billboard Top 40 charts exactly 30 years ago today. Guns N' Roses was huge then, and then in the years to come, a lot of people have written about their influence on rock music and controversy surrounding the band's lead singer, Axl Rose. I want to focus on this anniversary on Axl Rose's contributions to the English language. Thanks to him, we know that many words we think of as having one syllable actually have three. Here's the word mine, as in sweet child of. Oh, 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 My Yine. And now from Paradise City, please take me home. And this is the big one in the band's cover of the Bob Dylan song, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Now be careful if you start saying ho-om and do-or on your own, as I have done for many years. It starts to become a habit. So, you know, take the lesson from Axl Rose, learn from him, and thank you for continuing to listen to Central Taiyime.